You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. New Zealand may be the last large landmass populated by humans, but it has no shortage of strange phenomena. With over 40 years of investigation, Mark Wallbank has become a leading light in the Kiwi paranormal scene, alongside his team. Mark joins me to talk about his investigations and some of his favourite hotspots, the tools they've used, and some of the encounters they've had over the years. A big thank you to Mark for joining me this week. But before that, of course, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, bonus content, and more. Thank you to my latest patrons, Illy and Jani Banani. Thank you for joining the team, and thank you to each and every one of you that continue to support Mysteries and Monsters through Patreon. Mysteries and Monsters is across all social media platforms. Please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes and merchandise. Our intro and outro music are provided by the marvellous Weary Pines. Thank you as always to Dean Vestal for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now, New Zealand is our destination as we join Mark Wallbank to discover just how paranormal it is. The last large landmass to be populated. New Zealand is a country of stunning natural features, unique fauna and flora, and a rich history of hauntings. With over 40 years of investigation into the strange phenomena, Mark Wallbank has investigated locations and hauntings both in his homeland and abroad. With four books under his belt, an eclectic lust for hobbies, Mark is the perfect guide to New Zealand's haunted history. Mark, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters, sir.
Hello! What an amazing introduction.
Oh, you're very welcome. You're very welcome, Mark. It's very nice to see you in person again, obviously, because we met back in September when we were both at Parameet, as the British Summer decided to turn up for one day while you were there.
It was a great time. Loved it.
Yeah, it was fabulous. I was really looking forward to seeing you as someone that had got to know your work over the previous couple of years, Mark. I've always had a thirst for learning about countries' haunted histories, and New Zealand is one of those places that I think gets overlooked a lot, I think, due to the noisy neighbours you've got to the left. Sometimes you can get sort of caught in their shadow, but it's a fascinating place on a variety of levels, isn't it?
Well, we don't have the history that you guys have over there. We don't have that longevity of colonialisation and, so, you know, that sort of thing. But I think we've got a couple of hundred years, I suppose, of white men appearing on the shores.
Yes.
But of course, there are a lot of Maori folklore before that covers the whole sort of ghosts and paranormals and hauntings. So there's a lot of sort of stories that come from the Maori side of things as well. So I guess the paranormal has been sort of, you know, transcending all time eras and goes way back.
It is very interesting, like you say, because I think people would kind of suggest that really the settlers sort of turned up, as you say, about 200 years ago, because they turned up once and got kicked off the island basically and didn't come back for about 150 years because they had a proper Maori welcome for them, Mark. So really it's quite remarkable that you've got such a haunted history in the modern era, really, when you look at, say, in the written sort of westernized version of New Zealand's history, which obviously is predated by several hundred years by the Maoris, that you've got so much in such a short space of time, really.
Well, it just shows that the paranormal field itself, the paranormal sort of transcends all matter of time, doesn't it? It sort of does, you know, whether it's a recent event or if it's something that dates back a few hundred years or even a thousand years, there's no sort of time limits with it.
Mm. Yeah, it's almost as if it's entwined with the land itself, which is often something that I think as we delve more into the paranormal, as we grow older and we become a bit more experienced, we begin to think that often it's not just houses and homes and buildings that are haunted. You can have a haunting in any location, really.
Oh, no, we've got there's land over here that there have been numerous sightings of Maori warriors trekking across bushland and and things like that. So it's the haunting side of things. It can go right back. There are a lot of stories about Maori, the Maori scene. A lot of battles raged through a lot of the land here, a lot of the areas around the country. So it seems that the ghosts that are seen sort of date well back before colonialization, really. Back in the Maori Wars.
Yeah, certainly. I think as well, when you look at your sort of haunted history, Mark, you're quite remarkable, really, as you're possibly one of the youngest explorers in regards to the paranormal, because you started very early. So I'm always intrigued, especially when I speak to people from America or Canada or here in the UK. We've got certain touch spots or articles or magazines or programs or films that got us into it, Mark. And I don't know much about how that kind of field existed in New Zealand. Was it something that you were enticed to by a book in the library, or was it family stories, or was it a TV program you saw? What got you into the paranormal? Because for us everywhere else, we kind of know our touch points, but what were they for you in New Zealand growing up as a young person?
Well, I mean, for me, there was never really any paranormal TV or that sort of thing, or books or magazines that came from New Zealand right at the very beginning. For me, it was just a natural progression. I just had an interest in things that were out of the norm. I used to read a lot of comics, a lot of horror comics.
Yeah.
Even before I could read books, I would read comics, and I would just look at the pictures, and I would look for books of the unexplained, UFOs, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, ghosts, that sort of thing. So I would be looking at the pictures.
Yes.
And I was just fascinated by the idea that there were things outside of our understanding, things that were mysteries, things that we didn't understand and hadn't figured out yet. That sort of fascinated me. And none of my teachers at school could answer any of my questions. And all my questions, because what fascinated me was the unexplained and the mysteries of life. And those are the sort of questions that nobody has any answers for. So my teachers became frustrated with me because all my questions were based on the paranormal and cryptozoology and aliens and UFOs and that sort of thing. And they didn't have any answers. And even my questions about dinosaurs, I was fascinated by dinosaurs and that sort of thing. And of course, all the only information the teachers had for me was what they'd read themselves in books. So even dinosaurs were a bit of a mystery, really.
Mm.
And my questions were, the answers that I was getting from my questions, they just sort of, they weren't satisfying. You know, they weren't really, the answers just weren't satisfying to me. They just, they didn't really make sense. They didn't cover all bases. I was asking questions, the answers weren't coming back. And I figured, well, I'm going to have to find out for myself. So I just started, I had an idea that ghosts hung around old places. That's just, as a five-year-old child, that's what you believe.
Yeah.
So I was lucky that my family lived in an early part of Hawick and Pakuranga, which is at East Auckland, and it was all just cow paddocks and farmland, and it was all just undeveloped back then. We were the only house on the hill there.
Mm.
So all around us was just forest, bushland, and just farmland. And amongst that, there was old burnt-out farmhouses and old barns and just old ruins of places that used to be there many, many years ago. And so I would just trek down there as a five-year-old, put on my backpack, and off I'd go for the whole day, and I'd be exploring all these old houses and just sitting in them. And in my mind, I sort of felt, I mean, I'm not psychic or anything, but I felt that there was possibly something there. And so I would just talk to the air, as we do these days with paranormal investigation. I would just talk to the air and I'd ask questions, and I'd sit there for hours just chatting. And I guess these were my imaginary friends. I guess. I don't know if I can't remember if I got any answers or anything, but I sort of always felt like there was something there.
Yeah.
So I would just go out and do this. And I wasn't aware that anybody else was doing this. I just thought it was just something that I enjoyed doing, and I just did it. And it wasn't until I went into a secondhand shop in town, and I just stumbled across this book called Confessions of a Ghost Hunter, and it was by Harry Price. And it was the first time I'd ever heard of this guy. And it was the word ghost hunter that sort of stood out to me. And I started flipping through the cover, and it was going on about how he was the world's most forefront and pioneering paranormal investigator and ghost hunter. And I thought, somebody actually does this? There's actually somebody there looking? That's kind of what I do. Yeah. So I got this book. It was only like a dollar or something. It was very cheap. And I've read it many times since. And it was my first adult book. It was my first real read into that kind of field. And it wasn't until Ghostbusters came out, the movie Ghostbusters came, and there's that first scene at the beginning when they're in their big old library.
Yeah.
And it's the ghost in the library. And they're all walking around the aisles with their gadgets in their hands. I thought, wow, wouldn't that be great if you could have gadget, you could walk around looking for ghosts in an old library. I thought, wow, that would be so cool to be able to do. previous to that, all I'd had experience was Scooby-Doo.
Yes.
And even that I thought was great because I thought, wow, a bunch of people going out looking for ghosts, how cool would that be? Wish it was real life. When Ghostbusters happened and they had that scene, I thought, wow, that's cool. That's so cool. I wish that was real. But there's that moment where they're running out of the town hall screaming at the end, and there's that sort of fast soundtrack in the background, and they're all flying down the stairs, scared out of their wits. And there's this a few seconds of Dan Aykroyd and the look on his face of absolute sheer horror and shock as he's running down those stairs to escape whatever's in the town hall there. And as soon as I saw that look, I thought, that's what I want. That's what I want to experience. I want to experience that fear. I want to be chased out of a building by something, you know, something unknown and so mysterious that it just blows your mind. So that was my kind of spark, really, of just getting out there and doing it. But I didn't know that anybody else was actually doing this. I just sort of thought that it was just something that I enjoyed doing, and that was it. Then I found out there was actually people researching. There were television shows like the Leonard Nimoy one, which was very popular, and Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World. I was a big fan of that. And that was my first insight into paranormal research and the fact that there were people actually researching and studying and doing all this. And that just fueled it. It just fueled my desire to research it further. Mm. And it just went from there. I formed my first team in 1983, I think it was, 83. There were just three of us, just three little teenagers out there. And we were in early Howick, and there were still paddocks at that time and farmland. And we were just going out and doing our ghost hunting with torches. And we had an old audio recorder. And we had one of those old cameras that were just the old, you had the reel film in.
Yes.
And it would take 24 photographs, and you'd have a flash cube, which could only take like four flashes at a time.
Yes, you had to turn it round.
And you would take it to the chemist, and you'd have to wait for a week. You'd have to wait for a week for it to be developed. And then you'd get them back, and there'd be about maybe two or three photos that weren't blurry or.
Yeah.
And so we did that for about 3 years. And that was really good. And then we all sort of grew up and left school and moved on and separated. And I went solo for about a good couple of decades, I think. And it was about Ghost Hunters came on television. The show Ghost Hunters came on television. I thought, yeah, it'd be quite nice to have a team again. I quite enjoyed going out with a bunch of people doing this because I've been doing it for so long without it. And so I watched that, enjoyed it, and started piecing together my own team. And that was about 2009. So by 2010, we had a team, and we were out doing our thing. Here we are today.
So what was the paranormal scene like in New Zealand, Mark? Were there people that were sort of local celebrities or ghost authors? Because obviously here in the UK and America and other such places, you'd have people that would write series of books about famous hauntings. Obviously, you know, Peter Underwood catalogued every nook and cranny in the United Kingdom, it would seem, at some point during the 70s and 80s, and you've got other numerous authors that have done similar things. Was there anything like that in New Zealand to kind of build your early introduction into it that you'd got from Ghostbusters and discovering that Harry Price book? Or were you sort of self-sufficient in regards to you were sort of tracking down locations with your team and then on your own?
Well, there weren't really any writers. I mean, there weren't really any very early writers that I can remember. I found out sort of many years later that there were sort of researchers based in New Zealand that did do this kind of research, but they weren't really teams. They were just sort of independent researchers that would just be researching and studying. This was pre-internet, and so they did exist. They weren't really prolific or out there, so nobody ever heard of them. They were just people that were doing research, and most of their reading material was sourced from overseas anyway, as was mine too. But it wasn't until, you know, television sort of and the internet came around. There was one show that we had a TV show called Ghost Hunt NZ, and it was pretty bad. It was just a bunch of three non-paranormal investigators. Basically, they threw three celebrities together and just put them into investigations, and they had one guy that sat in the van with this little closed circuit television DVR camera system set up. He would look at this monitor, and of course there was the woman that screamed a lot, and you know, it was very very youth based. I think it was it hasn't aged very well, I don't think.
Yeah,
you can find it on YouTube. It is out there. there weren't any television programs. That was probably the first television program that we had. But when we get ghost hunters and all that sort of, when the internet came along, when the internet came along, we had access to YouTube, and so we could watch Ghostbusters or Ghost Hunters and those other shows. So it kept us going. I think the internet did help.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously when you got things like that, did you already know of some locations, Mark, from your early days, and you'd hear stories and urban myths and legends about certain places having reputations? And obviously, I mean, you've got some beautiful buildings all over New Zealand, and some grand opulent cinemas and theatres and wonderful old colonial buildings as well. Was there always that kind of history in regards to it? Because I know sometimes when I speak to people from Canada, it depends which part of Canada they grew up in, because certain places, they just don't talk about the paranormal, or they're not really very open about it. Whereas you can go to different parts, like here in England, you can't walk in a pub without them talking about the resident ghost Fred and throwing the glasses around or mucking about in the cellar. Was it that kind of environment in Auckland and beyond where you'd got places like that, or was it still very kind of hush-hush? What were people open about the paranormal?
Well, back before the internet came along, all we had was the newspapers. So you'd only really hear about a haunting if it was in the news. If it made the news, then we'd hear about it. And I collected files, so I collected newspaper clippings. So I've got a whole mass of books of just newspaper clippings that date right back.
Mm.
So the only ones I ever heard about were from the news, and I would hear about them. And being a kid, you know, it's too far for me to go if it was down the South Island or that sort of thing. So I would just have to just dream that one day I would get down there.
Yeah.
But basically it was the news media that fed me my information. There weren't really any books that sort of highlighted New Zealand's locations. There was one book I'll highlight. It was brought out by a good friend of mine, James Gilbert. He lives down in Wellington. And I've known him since we started. When we started up the team, we made contact with him.
Hmm.
But he'd brought a book out a couple of years before that, I think 2008, I think it was, called Spooked.
Yes.
And so he co-wrote that with another woman, Joe Davey.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that quite influential too, because it was just nice to know that there was a fellow Kiwi that was doing this kind of work. And it was his book that inspired me to start writing my own books, because we had all these files and reports from investigations that were done, and they were just sitting in files. They weren't actually, nobody could actually read them.
Mm.
And so I decided to just compile them into books and things. So it was that book, Spooked, by James Gilbert, that inspired my first book.
Yeah. I was very interested when I was reading your latest one, Haunted Auckland, that we'll dive into some of the locations in a short while, Mark. But there's a bit in it towards the back. And obviously, very much like myself, Mark, I'm interested in all aspects of the Fortean. I love Bigfoot, UFOs, strange encounters, mysteries, spontaneous human combustion would keep me entertained for hours. And you've got this short piece about this gentleman you met, Gary, I think his name was, who was claiming to being bothered by some strange dark entity, and you were dealing with some abductees and things. So was that sort of something that was running parallel, like myself, Mark? I'm interested in all aspects of it, and I can dip in from the paranormal into ufology, into cryptozoology, and then into strange things on top of all that. Have you always had those things sort of running parallel throughout your life in the weird?
Pretty much, yes. Back in the 80s, I used to run little talk gatherings. We would get together and just have discussion evenings as well. That was sort of in the late 80s, early 90s. And that was just in a local hall. And they were quite good. You got some interesting people turning up, some very sort of eccentric people would turn up. I started to get messages and letters from people that claimed to have been abducted. And I found that there seems to be a lot of people being picked up by aliens these days, because a lot of them are turning up to these discussion groups.
Yes.
And they seem genuine. They all seem very depressed and like it had really changed their lives. They sort of had this very sincere story to them about what happened on that day when they believed they were abducted. But I didn't want to judge, because, you know, you don't know.
Yeah.
So you just take everything at face value and just listen to their stories. And I think a lot of people appreciated the fact that there were people out there that would listen.
Mm.
Listen to the stories. So I've been talking to all sorts, people that have claimed, you know, demonic possession and demons in their houses, to alien abductions, to seeing mysterious creatures in the woods and all that. And, you know, as I didn't experience those things myself, all I can do is listen.
Yeah.
And it's the stories that have fascinated me. I've always been fascinated by the stories. And it's the stories that fuel me and all my research as well. And especially on my journeys, whether it be journeying, traveling around the country, Australia, over to the UK, I go where the stories are. And if somebody says that a certain house is haunted and has all this activity, I'll go to that location. And if I can stay there, I'll stay there. Mm-hmm. Same with creatures and cryptids.
Yeah.
If a certain piece of forest is meant to have been inhabited by some dog man or something like that, well, then I'll go spend time there. I'll stay a night. I'll sleep in a tent. see what happens. You know, just go there. Mm-hmm. I like that first-hand experience, whether it be talking mouth-to-mouth to that person.
Yeah.
And with the people that have had the experiences, or whether it be going to the locations myself and just seeing firsthand. So it's about getting that one-on-one interaction, whether it be me and the location or me and the other person that experienced.
Mm.
So I've spoken to some interesting people, yes.
Yeah, I can imagine. I think one of the strangest things I ever saw in the 90s, Mark, was obviously we had sightings shown over here on cable. And I remember him once doing a segment about a group of Japanese scientists who'd gone to New Zealand on the hunt for the moa. And they'd fetched loads of recordings, and I think they'd used some kind of, I think they'd recorded ostriches. How they'd worked out that ostriches sounded like moas, I'm not sure, but I suppose you can only go for the largest flightless bird you can find, I think, and hope it sounds similar. Do you still hear reports? Because obviously there are things. I'm a big believer in the fact that if we're talking about the paranormal and we're open to the concept of ghosts, I'm a big believer, and I'm a big lover of animal ghost stories. I find them fascinating because I think for a lot of people who are pet owners, they will always say, we've all got connections with our pets. Whether it's to the level we think it is on their side, I'm not too sure. But there's countless animals of all shapes and sizes that people have said to encounter, from horses to cows to pigs to cats and dogs. Do you put any sort of credence in some of these reports? Because I think it's one of those things that we can often, with our love of cryptozoology, we can often say, well, how's a big bloody bird like that still hiding out somewhere in the deepest recesses of New Zealand? But people are still very interested in trying their damnedest to see if this thing's still alive.
I mean, yeah, there are certain creatures that I do think could possibly exist. I mean, we do have this thing called the Moeho, which is meant to be the New Zealand equivalent of Bigfoot.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of people want it to exist, but there is so much against it not existing. For a start, it was based on Maori folklore.
Yeah.
On Maori folklore, basically, the Moeho man or the Moeho race, there were a bunch of hairy, hair-covered bipedal creatures with sharp claws and glowing red eyes. They were considered the guardians of forest, guardians of the forest, mainly the sort of Moeho range, which is the mountain range up in the Coromandel Ranges up in the North Island.
Yeah.
So the Maori believed that they were the guardians, and there are a lot of little stories that date way back, you know, hundreds of years, thousands of years, about the Moeho. But through the years, through the generations, the stories have changed. Back in the 1800s, there was an incident where a couple of gorillas jumped off a ship and escaped for a bit and sort of terrorized the town for a bit. And I think they were running around for about a day. I think one of them was shot and the other one was captured. So they did get them back. But for that sort of day or so, there were stories of gorillas running around terrorizing, and it was all on the news.
Yeah.
Many years later, there were a couple of brothers that decided to pull a prank. And so they went to the news and said that they'd seen a giant, you know, hairy creature. And it was fueled partly by the Maori folklore of these hairy creatures, the Moeho man.
Yeah.
Also, the gorilla story obviously influenced it a bit. And Bigfoot. They wanted to have a New Zealand version of Bigfoot. So they put these stories out there, and it went crazy. Everybody went mad. The media went mad about it. And it was these Bigfoot's creatures seen in New Zealand. And it was just a prank, but it did sort of have a bit of tread and carried on for a bit. Through to today, where we have people that really believe that they are experiencing Bigfoot's in New Zealand. I mean, the reality is our forests here are just so small, and they're so, the Department of Conservation have been through every meter of every forest. You know, it's all been explored. It's all been documented. It's all been, there are possum traps everywhere. It's all been done. It's all been found. It's all been tracked. It's all been documented. It's all been surveyed.
Yeah.
So there isn't any forest here really that is dense enough to be able to house a population, which is what is needed for them to survive, of creatures. Also, with the early versions of the Moiho man, the Maori versions, they're only about 5 foot tall. They're a short stature.
Yeah.
The ones that are apparently encountered today are 8 foot tall, giant Bigfoot creatures. So they're obviously been influenced by the American stories, where the stories have grown in time, I guess.
Yeah.
And the all the details have changed in time.
Yeah.
But we have got other creatures that have been kind of seen. Like, for example, there are a few sort of lake monsters. We had one in Lake Taupo, which hasn't been talked about for many years, but it did appear in a few newspaper clippings.
Yeah.
It was a large creature that was seen coming out of the water in Lake Taupo.
Mm-hmm.
And local to me, there's a lake called Lake Papuki, which is an old volcanic area. It was an old volcanic crater that is now a lake. And it's on the side of Lake Papuki is the Pump House Theatre, which is a theatre that we've investigated many times that we have residency, and we basically go there all the time and do it. So Lake Papuki is this dark, dark lake beside this haunted theatre. And there are news reports. I've got newspaper clippings that date way back into the 1980s of this giant creature that's said to live in the lake. And it's big enough to tip people off their kayaks and off their canoes. It's dragged dogs and birds and swans under the water and killed them. One sighting was of a couple of old men that were on a little boat.
Yeah.
They were out in the middle of the lake, and something came up and knocked their dinghy, and they described it as being this giant grey hump, sort of like a giant tractor inner tube.
Huh.
And it rolled beside their dinghy, and they said it was huge. The only thing we had that would sort of be similar to that would be the giant eels. We have giant eels here, which can grow to well over 100 years old, and they can grow quite wide and quite thick.
Yeah.
With the lakes, the various lakes we have, a lot of them have lava tubes where it's thought that these giant eels go into the lava tubes, and that's where they sort of pop away. So that's why you don't see them.
Mm.
And these lava tubes are they're big enough for a giant eel, but they're not big enough for a diver to swim into. So they're unexplored lava tubes. So I thought that that's where the monsters exist, and that's what they are.
Yeah.
So we've had lots of other ones. We've also had like a dog man. There's a dog man or dog boy that was seen down in Dunedin, in the South Island.
Yeah.
And we've had various large cats as well.
Yes.
Various large cats, moose, otters, other things like that. Things that aren't really native to New Zealand have been spotted here.
Yeah. I've heard something about, do they call them a ghost mooses or something like that? Were they brought over by somebody, Mark?
Yeah.
For farming or something, and got loose.
Yeah, there was I think back in the 1800s, I think it was, they were brought over and to try and breed and farm, and it was thought that it all died away and all became extinct over here. There were no more, but from time to time you do see a moose turn up, and there have been numerous photographs of the odd moose just showing up and then disappearing. So
yes.
They don't, you know, something the size of a giant moose. They're pretty big.
Yeah.
So I'm not too sure how something like that would disappear. But we have various black cats as well, which is always an intriguing one.
Yeah. I think it's very interesting because obviously New Zealand has a very distinct and unique animal population, similarly to Australia, Mark. And I know recently there's been a big sort of campaign to kind of cleanse some of the non-native species. I know you've got a real problem with feral cats and things like that because of a lot of the bird population of New Zealand is ground nesting, because obviously it's spent millennia being able to nest on the ground because it didn't have any kind of predators. So I know there's a big sort of ecological drive in the country to try and sort of claw back some of the natural habitat for the real creatures of New Zealand, isn't there?
Oh, there is. I mean, it becomes big news when we find a dead snake on the beach.
Yeah.
A snake will wash up, the dead one, and it makes the news. It's big news because we don't have snakes here. It's quite surprising that none sort of make it over from Australia, but from time to time, the odd one does make it over, and it's usually killed at the ports or wherever it arrives, or arrives dead on our shores. But we have had a few live ones that just have turned up and they're instantly just destroyed.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't want to be like our neighbours over in Australia with snakes and everything's out to kill you.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, I wasn't aware of anything about the legends and some of the stories about the New Zealand version of Bigfoot until I'd started doing this show. And I remember speaking to Tony Healy a couple of years ago, and I'd stumbled across an article about the same time, and I asked him about it, and he said, oh yeah, I don't think there's much to it. I think it's people getting overexcited about it. But obviously the Maoris are basically descendants from the Polynesian areas, aren't they? That they sort of, they're not sure why they came down, but they came down, and some people are saying it's because there was a volcanic eruption in the 13th century or something, and they needed farmland or something. But obviously if their concept of what they believe their protector of the forest would, that tends to sound more like things like the Oran Pendek and the Homo floresiensis, which were obviously dismissed for years until they found that cave full of little people bones, Mark. So for me, there seems to be more sort of truth to the Maori version of it than the modern interpretation of, like you say, I think people are wanting a Yowie or a Bigfoot to have canoed over for some reason.
I mean, as with a lot of cryptids out there, I do believe a lot of them did exist at some point. I mean, with Loch Ness Monster, I do believe in my heart that there was something there at one point, which is possibly, you know, long gone, but the stories carry on.
Yeah.
With the Moiho, I do believe maybe there was something there, whether it was just some sort of feral person, sort of feral group of people out there. I don't know, but there was, they were in the Maori folklore. They became part of Maori, the Maori storyline. So, I believe there was something that resembled what they describe that did exist, that they feared, because there were stories about them fighting them. They had to fight them off because they were vicious. And so they were having to survive and try and, you know, fight against these, this other race of creatures.
Yeah.
So I do believe there was something there, some sort of territorial thing there that did actually happen. Today, no, I think today it's basically based on people being influenced by television and movies, and everybody likes their idea that they have their own creatures as well. And the sad fact is not every country does have its own creatures. And I think television has a lot to answer for that. It just inspires and influences and, it just sort of indoctrinates people into this way of believing and knowing about their own country.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the people I've talked to are so sure that the Moiho man exists. They're so sure that it's out there. I've seen footprints, but the footprints they're showing me are in areas where people go hiking all the time. It's like two tracks. And it's just like, there was an old friend of mine, Rex Gilroy. I don't know if you've heard of Rex.
Yeah, yeah.
In Australia. Lovely old man. He passed away a couple of years ago. And he was a big influence to me. He was my Australian Indiana Jones. He was my, as a kid growing up, he was my big influence to get out there and look for creatures. And it was a thrill to meet him and spend time with him. And he took me out into the field quite a bit. And we went bush trekking for many, many years, for quite a few years. And it was great to hang out with him. He came over to New Zealand a few times looking for the moa and looking for signs of the Moiho as well. He didn't find any Moiho signs, but he did find tracks of a moa. And I know Rex. I've known Rex quite well, and I know that he's not a hoaxer. He doesn't make things up like that. And he is a little bit controversial about some of his ideas. And I've seen Rex pick up a rock. He would pick up a rock and goes, that looks like it could be a skull. Look, you can see where the eye socket might be. And that could be a mouth, and that could be. And you start looking and thinking, okay, maybe he's reading too much into it. Maybe he's just being a bit too hopeful.
Yeah.
But there are certain things he has got. He's got a lot of fossils and a lot of tracks and castings of claw marks and that are just huge.
Mm.
You know, and some of the ones, I mean, some of the, he had a mower track that was just like massive. It was the size of what would you expect a moa claw to look like.
Yeah.
A big three-toe track. And he had a big plaster cast, which he brought back from New Zealand from his trips over here. And he found numerous tracks, but of course he only had a certain amount of plaster cast with him to make one casting.
Yeah.
But he's found bits where, you know, dirt was dug up, like it was clawed.
Yeah.
Clawed up, you know, looking for bugs and grubs and things like this. The nearest bird that we would have, which would be the closest, I guess, to a moa, it would be a lot shorter, it would be the takahe.
Mm.
The takahe is a lot smaller than a moa, but it has got the big clawed feet and they're quite stocky. They have a short neck and all that, so it's not quite the description.
Mm.
But he found quite a bit of evidence there, which made me think maybe the moa thing is something that, you know, possibly in a small population, but I don't know.
Yeah.
Creatures like that, they need a population, don't they, to exist?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, well,
go down the whole track, which I don't know if I'm ready to go through that way. whether they pass through portals to come over. I don't know. I mean, I'm not ready to go there just yet.
Well, you never know. I mean, there are numerous examples, like, you know, as you touched on earlier about black cats and stuff. I mean, they're seen everywhere, such as yourself and next door in Australia. We get them here. I mean, there's a story here near enough every week, Mark. And I've spoken to enough people in the farming industry in my local area to be absolutely convinced that there's something going on here. Whether they're all black, melanistic cats of some description, I'm not too sure, but there's clearly something going on here, and we've had enough non-native large cats killed in the last 40, 50 years to suggest that there's clearly territory that they'd be able to sort of hide away. Because cats, even a domestic cat, you can lose your own cat in your own house for a day if they don't want to see you, they'll just bugger off, won't they? So if you've got a massive expanse of open area, there's nothing for me that can tell me that they're not going to be out there. I mean, I heard one argument saying, well, they're not going to like living in this country, it's too cold. And I thought, have you never heard of snow leopards? Do you think tigers just live in where it's sunny? It just baffles me sometimes. Yeah. I mean, the name Siberian tiger should give you a clue at least.
One that's always fascinated me was the old Mekelle Membe.
Yes.
Dinosaur, yes. That's one that's always fascinated me, even as a child. It just seemed so plausible. And the fact that you've got villagers, you've got the people that have lived there all their lives through generations that have seen these things and the stories, and they can describe it so well. And you can have researchers that'll go over there and show them pictures of all these other things. But when they get to a picture of an old dinosaur, that's the one that they point to.
Yeah.
And they know the creatures. They've lived there all their life. They've, through generations, they know what's in that forest. They know what's in that woodland. They know.
Mm.
So for them to point out a dinosaur and say, that's it.
Mm.
And the stories, I mean, that's just something that's always fascinated. I just love the idea that there are prehistoric creatures. And that, again, takes me back to the whole portal idea.
Yeah.
Are these creatures coming back through some sort of time portal?
Yeah.
You know, how can they disappear and come and go? I don't know. I don't want to go down that track just yet. I'm not ready. But, you know, you've got to consider it these days. These animals just sort of appear and then disappear without trace for a long time. The amount of times I've heard stories about Bigfoot, he's seen clear as day in the daylight, then suddenly he'll step behind a tree and he'll disappear.
Yeah.
You think, where does he go? It's daylight. He's just gone behind a tree and he's disappeared. Is that a portal? How else can he disappear? You know? You know, I guess things are getting so crazy these days. You have to consider all the angles now. It's,
absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, as we were saying earlier on as well, I mean, let's be honest. If we're going to be very open-minded about it, why can't there be the ghost of a dinosaur? I mean, what rules that out? You can't say, oh, we only get ghosts of mammals. Well, why? How's that work?
Like, at our place, you say you've got a misty one at your place. We've got a crazy cat lady ghost at our place.
Yeah?
Both my wife and I have both seen her numerous times. She's always wearing the same clothing, and she's very sort of, I guess, 70s or 80s looking. She has a bright red top.
Yeah.
And she's wearing white pants. It's very sort of old 70s look.
Yeah.
And it was the bright red that caught out both of our eyes. It's just the bright red. You see the bright red? Because and they're always in our back garden. It's in our backyard.
Yeah.
Which is also bush. It's all very green. So this bright red that stands out, it catches your eye.
Yeah.
And both my wife and I have both seen her. And she's got a big, massive, big, white, puffy sort of white hair.
Yeah.
Big, curly white hair. Bright red top, white pants, and she's just walking around the garden.
Yeah.
And we thought this was unusual. And when we moved into the house, we've got a 1980s house. It was built in the 80s. And when we moved in, we noticed that there was a cat door built into one of the doors, and a lot of the neighbors' cats would just sort of walk in. They'll just sort of come in the middle of the night. You'd hear cats fighting down in the living room and fighting. Where are these cats coming from? And the cats, sort of all the stray cats that were around the area, because we have a lot of bush around our area, a lot of woodland and bush. And the cats were just, a lot of strays would just come in, come through the cat door and just sleep in our lounge, you know. And we didn't know how this was happening and why. And then we saw this lady. We thought, who's this lady? And there was an old woman that used to live down our driveway, and she was moving out of her house. She was selling her house. And she'd been here right from the beginning when the street was being built. Mm. And she knew this, who used to live in our place. And she told me that I asked her about this woman, and I even described it to her, what we'd seen. And she said, that sounds like her. Yep. And we talked about the cats, and she said, oh, she was a cat lady. And she used to feed all the stray cats in the area. They would all come and she would feed them all. And that's why the cats would come to her house. So the house is known for its crazy cat lady. And one time I was down in the garage. I was down in the garage and I smelt this full on thick cigarette smoke. Like somebody was in there smoking a cigarette with me.
Yeah.
And none of it smoke. And there was nobody nearby that would just smoke. That would sort of filter into the house. And I asked the woman about smoking, because I was just curious about that incident, and she said she was a chain smoker. So she was a chain smoker, and so all these little things just sort of fitted together. I was like, wow, okay, maybe we have a crazy cat lady ghost that likes to hang out in the garden, and that's why all the cats come to our place. And my wife has seen a lot of sort of little shadow ghosts, like little, she calls them cat ghosts.
Yeah,
we've seen a few of those sort of roaming around the house. So yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, it's quite nice. I quite like the idea.
Yeah, I suppose it's quite comforting. It's quite a pleasant ghost then, Mark.
Yeah, we haven't seen her for years, but we've both seen her at separate times, wearing the same clothes. Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, well, like you say, it's very distinctive. You know, that's not the kind of thing you're going to mistake, is it? You know, if something's bright red against a green background, you know what you're seeing there.
And that's what catches your eye. You see the bright red thing at the corner of your eye, and look, oh, and there's a woman standing there. And then she just disappears. fascinating, yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, well, fantastic. Oh, excellent. Well, it's one of those things as well. It shows you that, you know, even if... I mean, how long have you had that property now, Mark?
About 18 years, I think, now.
Yeah, yeah. And do you still get cats sort of squatting in, coming in?
yeah, from time to time, they find our place and they sort of come up. It's almost like they know that this is the place to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Come here. So we've had kittens and we've had cats laying kittens, giving birth to kittens in our garage. And it's like a safe place. It's a sanctuary for them, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you never know. I mean, obviously, the intelligence of animals and how they can communicate is, you know, it's a completely alien concept to a lot of people. But we see so many things in the animal kingdom where you wonder, how does that get passed on? You know, you only have to look at like turtles and salmon. It's almost as like they're wired to return to somewhere they've never been. It's a very strange thing. So why wouldn't you be sort of the hotspot on the cat network in the local area, Mark?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah.
Warbanks Hotel for cats, Mark. I suppose, as well, obviously leading into that's kind of like a ghost hunter's dream, really, is to buy a property completely without wishing to own a haunted home and to basically have a resident spirit wandering around, one that seems a very pleasant one. I suppose with some of the work that you've done, and I know you mentioned about the theatre that on the lake shore. One of the things I've always been very impressed with is the fact that you seem to build up really good relationships with property owners, where you get sort of a residency that you can spend a lot of time. Because I think often the frustration for a lot of paranormal investigators is that you get a fleeting opportunity to investigate a property, or you might only have a very small window of time. Whereas I know a lot of the work you've done repeat visits, and you've had a residency, as we were referring there, for 2 to 3 years, where you can come and go and spend some real time there trying to sort of pin down and record as much phenomena as possible.
Yeah, I think it's we've been very lucky in that respect. It's again, it comes down to reputation, and it comes into just we're really working to build that trust.
Mm.
Because it does take a lot of trust for a location, especially with antiques, and there's, you know, valuables there, to just let you stay the night. And just, I mean, we've got places that we sleep in. We just go there and we'll just sleep. We'll bring a little air mattress along, and we'll just put the air mattress up, and we'll sleep. And we're very lucky. I do believe that the way to research is, it's pretty much like, I guess, the same as the Bigfooting approach with habituation. the habituation approach, where basically you keep returning to those areas, you spend time in those areas, you camp out in those areas, and eventually the Bigfoots will become familiar with you and start to come around and show themselves more. And I think it's the same with the ghost side of things. I think if they are aware of your existence, and if they are aware of you being there, and if they are indeed intelligent and conscious and able to feel or see in some way, which we don't understand, but we're assuming, I guess, if they are able to do those things, then friendship should be possible. You should be able to make friends as you would with a human person. You should get to know them and find out about them. And if we're able to communicate, then, you know, it opens it up, right, you know, to learning a lot more from them. And my main goal, even as far back as a kid, was basically to not only find out, I mean, I've always sort of known that ghosts exist. I mean, I know that ghosts do exist. Hmm. I just don't know what they are. They do exist, but I don't know what they are.
Yeah.
Somehow people are experiencing them. People are experiencing something. I mean, whether it's some sort of subconscious mental thing that we're all experiencing, whether it's something within the planet itself that's creating these delusions, I don't know.
Yeah.
But we're all, yeah, so many people are experiencing it. And you've got to, when you look at the facts, I mean, these are people from all parts of the country, all parts of the world, even the more isolated parts of the world that don't have Western influence, you know, movies, books, television, internet, that kind of thing. Mm. They have their stories of ghosts. So ghosts are everywhere, and they date back many, many years and generations. So you can't dismiss that. Mm. People are seeing something. They're experiencing something. And that's what's fueled me as a kid. I've always believed that there's something there, but we just don't understand it yet. And so my journey has been to basically just find out what they are.
Yeah.
What am I experiencing? What are other people experiencing? And I've gone to places where I've experienced things that other people have made claims about experiencing. So I know that they're not just making it up, because I've experienced the same things that they've experienced themselves. And I'm very skeptical about a lot of things. I'm probably the most skeptical in our team. I'm not just a straight up blind believer. I have to see things to believe them, which is why I go to these places and spend times in places to find out for myself. And you know, I've seen enough and felt enough and experienced enough to know that there's something going on.
Yeah.
So it's worthy. It's worthy of all this research and effort. And I firmly believe that going to these locations and just spending more and more time there is the way to go.
Hmm.
We've had quite a few. We've got two places at the moment that we have unlimited access to, which is really good. But we have had other places in the past. We had one that was an old girls' school.
Yes.
And we had that for about 2 years. And we did about 25 visits there over 2 years. And we would sleep the night. I'd just go there by myself and just sleep. And it's the same with the Lake House Art Center at the moment. We're doing that one. And we're sort of making great strides with what we're accomplishing there. I mean, sometimes it'll be a Friday or a Saturday night, and I'll think, oh, I've got nothing to do. I might go sleep at the lake house.
Yeah.
So I'll just get my air mattress, and I'll just go sleep the night there. give the wife a bit of time off. And, you know, just set up some cameras and just see what happens, you know. And I do believe that we're becoming closer and closer to getting the evidence that we need to be able to make some sort of decision. With the girls' school, we had some incredible activity coming, and we don't use lots of gadgets. We don't use lots of BP REM pods, and we don't use dowsing rods, and we don't really use all the sort of bad gadgets that are out there. We just don't use them. You know, they're toys. We do try them out. To be fair, we try them out, and we've wasted a lot of money buying these things just to try them out.
Yeah.
But if we don't see anything valid in them, we just chuck them in a box. Don't use them.
Mm.
So I don't really use gadgets very much. I mean, I have got a few basics that I'll use, like a millimeter for temperature and EMF. I'll use that, and we have a couple of other bits and pieces that can sort of measure the atmospheric data and that sort of thing. I want to document data.
Yeah.
I want to document any atmospheric changes. Plus, I want a video record. I'm big on video, so I video everything with multiple cameras everywhere. So I want to capture things on video. So I think, yeah, return visits is the way to go. And we're very lucky. But again, it's taken many, many years of building this trust.
Mm. I suppose as well, like you say, it's quite refreshing, because I know sometimes people can seem to become obsessed and addicted to having all kinds of newfangled gadgets, Mark. And my personal experience and what I know enough to know that a lot of them are kind of creating a bias in the user, because they're giving people the results they want or they expect. And therefore, there are certain products that if you leave them running long enough, you will see it begins to repeat itself. It has a set process. It will eventually start to repeat itself. So then you can think, well, this is a flawed mechanism. This will always give a similar result if you leave it running long enough. And therefore, if you're using something like that for investigation, for me, it's worthless, because it's designed to tell you that something's occurring without sort of giving you any sort of hard data in regards to why that's occurring. So it's better to kind of go back to the basics, like you say, and use your own sights and sounds, document everything, video things, taking pictures. I know you've used torches in the past as well and things like that, and trying to do that. Do you use things like trigger objects when you're in a specific location? Or is it a case of, because of your experience with both yourself and the team, Mark, you've kind of got to a point now where you're very confident in the kind of kit you and the team would take to an investigation? Or is it you're still going through a trial and error process, that if you go to a new location, you might try something you haven't used for 2 or 3 years? Or have you got your sort of half a dozen things that you say, right, I need this, 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 and this, that's all we'll need for this?
No, I'm always trialing new things. If somebody comes to me and says, this gadget, we've had amazing activity with this one gadget, you've got to get one, I will ask them, what sort of activity are we talking about here? And then they'll start telling me about the activity that they've been having. And then if I can sort of offer a few explanations to why that activity will be occurring, I would sort of put those questions forward to these people and say, well, have you considered this, 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 this? Could that be triggering your gadget? But yeah, we do use a lot of trigger objects, mainly because they're cheap and they're simple and they're easy to pick up. Anything can be used as a trigger object. And so I do use trigger objects just in the name of giving things a go and trying. It's all trial and error, and it's about experimentation as far as I'm concerned. So I just try everything. Some things work, some things don't. Some things I'll stick with, some things I'll just give up on. Gadgets, I'm a bit like that. I'll try it for quite a few sessions. And if it's just not showing anything valid, I'll just won't bother. Because for me, any access you get to a location is valuable. It's valuable time. And if you're wasting it on a spirit box or an app that may or may not be giving any valid data, you've just wasted that session, and you may not be able to get to that location again.
Yeah.
So you've got to use your time wisely. It's very important. I see teams that'll turn up. They'll talk about how scientific they are and how skeptical they are. They'll turn up to their investigation. That investigation will be a live feed. It'll just be it'll be alive. And it's not an investigation anymore. It's alive for their patrons, and it's basically just an entertainment now. And they'll turn up and they'll switch on their spirit box or their app, their word app. And that's it for the whole session. And they'll be there for an hour or two, and that's their whole that's their serious scientific research, listening to an app, which has got a built-in library of words, which is just going randomly through this built-in library of words that were put in by the creator of that app. So, I have to sort of question, how can time be more wisely spent in these sessions, If you've got a place for one session and you're only allowed in there for 4 hours, I think that for me, the best idea would be set cameras up everywhere, every angle, cover everything, video the whole session from beginning to end, and then have a few gadgets positioned around the place to see if anything is triggered. And that's pretty much it. And you just sit quietly and observe. I do a lot of investigations by myself. I do a lot of independent stuff. I do a lot of solo investigations, because sometimes I feel that the more team members you have in an investigation, the less you're going to get back, the more contamination you're going to get, more noise, more bodily movement, that sort of thing. Whereas if you're there by yourself, it's just you and the building. That's it. You and the building. So any sounds that come out of that will be you or the building or wishful thinking, something else.
Yeah.
If you've got other team members there, there's a lot of chance that it could be one of them. So, I think it depends on the location. But, gadgets, not so much. I've tried a lot of apps. I've tried a lot of other various gadgets and trigger objects and haven't really found much from me. They may work for other people. Other people get a lot of evidence, I guess, from them. But for me, no. And another thing I found with the apps is, though, especially the word apps, people are listening to the word that are spitting out from this gadget. from this phone, and they start piecing together a storyline from those words. And they may get the first word, which could be water. The first thing that's thinking, okay, water. Did you drown? Did you drown? Is there a lake nearby? Did you drown? Is that how you died? And the next word might come back as, you know, fall. Okay, did you fall in the water? Did you drown by falling in the water? And before you know it, after 2 hours of listening to this phone app, you've got this whole story, which could be completely false and completely wrong, completely made up on the fly.
No, absolutely. There seems to be some people are quite happy to create a narrative with no real relevance, like you say, other than just random words coming out, and they create a story. It is a strange thing, and I think that leaps to the belief of what they want to happen rather than investigating. They've decided that this place is haunted, and therefore they want to know what their version is that they've created in that app. Kind of aspect. And it's a shame because, you know, as you were saying there about the girls' school or the theatre, what was it that sort of pulled you to those locations? Because obviously one of the things you do, I know, is that you do a lot of investigation, and when you've got a public property, Mark, you interview a lot of the people there, you speak to people, you build up a history from experiences, and also you use archives to look at, is there any truth in this? Because you're one of those people, you're very quick to dismiss things or point out that these are urban legends and myths. Yep. And I know there's a couple of things in the book where you talk about these stories of witch houses and things, which is something of a bit of a strange concept for me, but it's obviously something that's ingrained in all cultures around the world. But when you're looking at, say, the girls' school, what was it that, why did that come to your attention? Was it something that had a reputation as an educational centre that it was suffering a haunting whilst it was still working, and is it still an operational school?
No, well, I was quite lucky with that one. That was actually via my wife, actually. She works as an operations manager for the ADHB, the Auckland Hospital, and there was this old building that they'd leased for a couple of years as to use as one of their admin buildings. And so there's this massive old building, and it used to be, it was a former girls' school many years ago, and a very old building that they used. There's upstairs and a downstairs. There's a top level, bottom level, and that's where all the offices were. They had all their desks and computers downstairs. But everybody was too frightened to go upstairs. It was just this empty area. They were even too scared to store things up there. It was unused because the people working downstairs, all they would hear would be footsteps walking above. They'd hear things being dragged across the ceiling above them. Mm. Like there was somebody up there, and people would go up there, and there was nobody up there. It was just empty.
Yeah.
So I got to the point where they just stayed away. So they had this whole top level of this building that was just empty. And there's a big stairwell leading up, big creepy old stairwell leading up to it. And so she said, they've been hearing all these things. And she'd mentioned to one of her bosses that I was a paranormal researcher. And they said, we should have a look. Is there something going on up there? So that's how we got it, basically. It was through her. So we had the keys, and then we could go anytime we wanted. And it was great, and things were happening. We had some interesting stories there, but it was sheer luck. It wasn't locally known about the activity. It was just those that worked there knew about the activity, and that's pretty much as far as it went. So it was a very lucky score for us, really. It was we got this whole building until the lease ran out, and then they moved out, and so we lost that one. But we were going there so often that things were happening every time, and it wasn't just. It was little things. It wasn't major activity. It was little things like you would hear the sound of a piano being played downstairs. And there's a room down there which used to be the chapel. There was a chapel room, and there would have been a piano at some point down there. So you'd hear a piano being played. We heard voices. We heard footsteps. There was one time where the team were down the bottom of the stairwell doing a communication session, and there was a big stairwell going up behind them, and there's a big locked door which led up to the top floor, and it was locked at the time. And all of a sudden you hear the door rattle, and we caught it all on video. It basically rattles and goes clunk like the door's opening, even though it's locked. Mm. And then you hear this creak. Creak, like floorboards bending as something's coming down the stairs towards us. Oh. And we all stopped and looked, and we thought, you can see us on camera. We're just like, what was that? Footsteps? That's something coming down the stairs, you know? And we all heard it, and it was just one of those amazing little moments that happened there. Wow, you know? We had another incident where we decided to do a Facebook live feed, a live stream for a bit, because we were doing a few of those from time to time, and people were enjoying them, joining in with our investigation. And plus, with these ongoing locations that we do have, it gives us a bit of a more relaxed attitude towards it. We can take our time because we can come back anytime we want.
Yeah.
So that gave us freedom to just sit around and chill and just do what we want. If we wanted to do a Facebook live feed, we could do one. It wouldn't hinder any old time restraints or anything like that. It wouldn't hinder our research. Yeah. We could just do it for fun, and it wasn't an issue. So we did these live feeds. There's this old toilet area. It was like a communal sort of girls' toilets and showers area. And so I put the live feed up there, and we just left our audience there on a tripod, just sort of monitoring that room. We said, oh, yeah, let's not hear anything. We were downstairs having some snacks, because we always used to bring lots of snacks and biscuits and whatever. Yeah. So we were downstairs having a break, and somebody was watching the live feed on their tablet. And she's like, oh, they're saying that they're hearing voices. They can hear voices. And sure enough, people were claiming that they could hear children giggling and laughing and cheering, almost like a children's playground. But this was 3 o'clock in the morning, and they were hearing like a children's playground at a school, is what it was. So I went upstairs, and I couldn't hear it with my ears. I couldn't hear what they were hearing. I couldn't hear it with my ears. So I put my headphones on, and then I had my headphones switched into my audio recorder, turned that on, which kind of amplifies the sound that the audio recorder is picking up on. Mm-hmm. I could hear it just very faintly. It was coming through, and it just did sound like kids in the playground running around squealing and laughing. And yeah, it was that. I could hear what they were hearing, which made me sort of consider the idea that maybe a lot of EVPs are transmitted electronically somehow. Whether this whole paranormal field, maybe if they are based in energy, of some sort of energy field,
yeah,
somehow, maybe that audio is an energy as well. And it's like radio frequencies. The radio frequencies are floating around the airwaves, aren't they?
Yeah.
So maybe EVPs are like that, where they're recorded sounds that are just floating on the air. And sometimes you can capture them through an electronic recording device, maybe. Mm. It's kind of a theory that I've been toying around with. And it's kind of interesting that it was coming through on the live feed electronically, and I could hear it through the audio recorder, but it didn't record it.
Mm.
It was, I could hear it on the headphones because the headphones were amplifying it. So I found that quite interesting that, yeah, we could hear it electronically.
Mm. You always continued to use EVP, Mark? Because that seems to be one of the things about paranormal investigation, that it used to be really prevalent up in sort of the late 90s, and then it completely fell out of fashion. And I've noticed over the sort of the last 5 or 10 years, it seems to be really coming back round again. And I've been listening to a lot of old investigators with EVPs and some of what they've captured over the years, especially some of the people that were on the Art Bell show in the 90s and the early noughties. And there are only two possible conclusions here. It's either real or it's a hoax. There's no middle ground for some of the things that people record in these kind of aspects. Whilst you can always say there may be some kind of external contamination, you know, sometimes you will have people who have done this and they will do call and response, and they don't hear the response until they go back through the audio that they've been recording. Is that something that you've always had in your paranormal toolbox, or is it something that you've used to use when you first started and you drifted away and come back to it? Or is it now something that you, because of things like this, where you've got experiences where you can hear it through an audio feed, but you can't hear it live and it's not recording, but you know there's a noise there because you can clearly hear it?
Well, for me, I mean, we have had people in the team that were right into their EVPs, and they sort of specialised in audio recordings. For me personally, I prefer video cameras. Because video, you get the audio and the video.
Yeah.
So the video camera will be recording the scene. It'll be recording all the people in the room. You can see their mouths if anybody does make a sound or murmurs something to themselves. So I prefer video cameras, and I've captured a few sort of, I guess EVPs via video cameras. But I'm not really into the whole idea of just putting an audio recorder down, because it just takes so long to review it. And yes, it takes me long enough to review video recordings.
Yeah.
So I'd rather review a video recording where I can actually look at the picture,
yeah,
instead of just listening to an audio recorder where I'm having to just hear it.
Yeah.
You can get more data and more information about a scene or a certain moment from a video camera.
Mm.
So I tend to use video cameras. But, yeah, we do EVPs. It doesn't interest me as much as it used to these days, because I'm more into video these days. You find your little niches and things that interest you more.
Mm.
But I guess the longer I do this, the more old school I get. I'm sort of getting rid of all the modernized things now that just don't interest me, because I know how they work. I figure them out.
Mm.
Spirit boxes, cat balls, K2 meters, all these things that are open for misinterpretation and false positives and all that kind of thing.
Mm.
With experience, you kind of figure these things out.
Mm.
And you learn from them and you move on.
Yeah.
And if a certain gadget is prone to having so many false positives or so many misinterpretable bits of data coming back from it. I mean, it's just not worth it. It's just, you know, if it has so many multiple explanations for it going off or being triggered, I just don't bother anymore because it's, you know, it becomes too convoluted with just, yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It takes a lot of belief, I guess.
Yeah. And like you say, if you're using certain apps, you end up relying on the technology and not your personal experience. That leads the investigation, Mark. And therefore, as with anything, it can lead you into blind alleys, really, and you end up wasting too much time on things that could be simply a technical fault.
Yeah, exactly. So we have various gadgets that we use, and we just spend a little bit of time on each one and just see how they go. Sometimes we'll just have a whole lot of them going at one go at one time, and we just see what's working, what's not. But we try not to spend too much time just doing one thing, except for video camera. Of course, we film everything continually.
Yeah.
So everything's done continually. So if something does happen, then we're there to capture it.
So how did the opportunity to work at the Lakeside Theatre come about then, Mark? Was that something that, because of your reputation in the team and the way you've conducted yourself in other buildings, that they came to you? Or was it something that you'd been made aware of through people talking about their personal experiences in the media or whatever, that you thought, oh, this sounds an interesting place, and you went and approached them?
It was pure luck, really. Again, it was I drove past it many times, and it's just this big old house that sort of sits on this sort of reserve. It's just a big grass area that's used for football matches and sports and things. It's just a big football field with a big house sitting on the edge of it. And I've driven past it and I thought, oh, I wonder if they've got any stories. And I just sort of happened to I got their email address and just sort of sent them a message saying, hi, my name's Mark and this is what I do, and just wondering if you have any stories. You know, I've seen the place for many years, and I'm just curious, wondering if you've had any stories. It just so happened that the guy that managed the area, managed the lake house, was right into the whole paranormal. He loved it, and he's a real believer. So he had a whole lot of files of his security camera, and he asked me what my explanations were. It was all just dust and insects and spider webs.
Yeah.
But all captured on his security camera. He firmly believes it's ghosts, so I'm not going to judge. But he said, yes, we've got so many ghosts in here. We've got so many ghosts. Yeah, we've got them all captured on video camera. And I got all excited, but then I saw his video footage and I thought, oh, okay, all right. But he gave us access to the place, and we started to do our thing, and we started to get all this interaction and all this sort of activity started coming back. And it was interactions with various gadgets, various pop lights, and we used different types of lighting and stuff like this, tapping and various sort of sounds of movement and little shadows. We were seeing short shadows walking around the place, and just all these little interesting things that thought, maybe there's something more to this. Maybe it's not just dust. Maybe we should spend a few sessions here, and we'll, you know. And he gave us unlimited access to the place, so we can come anytime we want. Because he wanted to find answers. He wanted us to come in and try and document some of the things that he believed in. So we started spending time there. And then we started hearing this, and then we started to get interactions which appeared to come from a little girl. All these little things that we were getting sort of pointed towards it being a child and maybe a little girl. And then we started doing all these sessions, experiments with push lights, little trigger lights that we're doing. And we were getting responses to questions on these trigger lights that would flash and go off and on the light for it wasn't the old torchlight one where you loosen the back bit. It wasn't like that. It was kind of these little push lights that you stick in shelves and you sort of push it and the light goes on.
Yeah.
You know, to light up a cupboard or something.
Mm-hmm.
And very quick and basic, but they started to go off in response to the questioning. So we just sort of thought, let's go with this and just see where it leads. And we were quite amazed that with our questions, we were getting answers spot on with this light flashing, and we were able to go through the alphabet and get letters and stuff like letters and numbers and things like that.
Wow.
And there was no other flashing outside of those questions. It was just like spot on as an answer.
Yeah.
So we thought, look, let's just go with this, because what I like to do is if something's happening, I like to go with it and see where it leads me. And if it leads nowhere, then fine, then move on to something else.
Yeah.
But this didn't seem to end. It just carried on and on and on. And so we started picking up that we asked her her name, and we started going through the alphabet. We got that her name was Patricia, and she liked to be called Patty.
Yeah.
So we said, okay, we don't know if this is accurate or not, but we'll go with Patty.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got this young, you know, 9-year-old girl called Patty, who apparently died there, and she lives there now. So we had all these little bits and pieces of information, and we had various other investigators that joined us, and they were seeing short shadows, and we were all hearing footsteps, which sounded like a young child running around upstairs.
Yeah.
It was that pitter-patter of feet. We were all hearing these things, and everything pointed to it being a young person. So we kind of went with that. We thought, okay, we'll just see how long this patty thing goes. We don't know. It might lead to nothing, but we'll just see how it goes. And we started hearing all these stories. People started approaching us. As soon as we started putting it out on our Facebook page and on our website, that our findings, we started getting all these stories back from people that used to live in the house before it was moved to its current location.
Mm.
And it was open as a community house. It was open. It had many different uses. And we found out that there was a young girl there, she's been seen on the stairwell many times in its current place and in its old previous place,
mm-hmm.
A young girl that was thought to live there. And she turned up at birthday parties and all sorts of stuff. She would just be standing there, this young girl. And she was heard running around upstairs. And yeah, so it was interesting that this entity that we've sort of happened to be picked up on, and we had a lot of assumptions with it,
mm-hmm.
but we sort of went with it just to see where it led us. And it started to be, it was basically matching up with all these other experiences that other people had way before we had even arrived on the scene.
Hmm.
So that's quite interesting. And now we're still getting stories that we had one recently that came back. The manager contacted us and said that there's this woman that went to a birthday party when she was a young child, back when the house was in its original position on Lake Takapuna, which is where it used to stand. And she went to a party and she ended up seeing this young girl on the stairs, and she went up and talked to her, and this girl didn't talk, and she was just standing there motionless and wouldn't talk to anybody, and apparently nobody knew who she was, and she just disappeared. And we're thinking maybe that was an early sighting of Patty, maybe.
Oh.
The original location.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But it's been an interesting little journey so far, that we're getting all this information. Whether it's valid or not, we don't know, but it's this whole mystery that's kind of unfolding, and it's quite fun to be part of.
Yeah. So how quickly into your investigation did this sort of channel of communication start, Mark? Was it something, as you were saying earlier, you were referring to, you know, when you start to investigate somewhere and you start going on a regular basis, it's almost as though they get used to you, or they want to welcome you, or they want to start a channel of communication of some kind. Did it kind of, was it a slow burn to build up to that, or was it something where it sort of, after a while, it just started and it didn't stop?
Yeah, the first few sessions were duds. We didn't really have anything happen. I think it might have been the third one, and we just kept going there because we had free access to the place.
Yeah.
And the guy had given us free access. We thought, why not? Let's just, if anything, it'll be good practice for us to use gadgets and just, you know, get field experience.
Yeah.
And just things were happening, so we kind of went with it, but. Yeah, it didn't happen immediately, but then when things did start to happen and we had what we felt might have been a name, I mean, we don't know how this whole name thing happened, because when you're asking questions and you're getting responses, we don't know if there's a lag. There could be a lag in time, and when it landed on the P for Patty, it might have been M. It might be Mary. You know, we don't know.
Yeah.
So there could be a lag, so we could be completely off on the name. We don't know. But we are seeing short shadows. We are hearing pitter-patter of little feet. We are all these little things that kind of point to it being a young person.
Mm.
Then you've got all the stories that come from previous to us being there, of young child, young girl, that kind of thing. So, yeah, we just you just sort of go with it, really. But we've noticed that now that we start calling out Patty and we start bringing toys for her to play with, and we kind of angle our research so it's sort of pointing to, you know, so it's aimed at a child, something a child might be interested in. We've found that the activity seems to be happening more regularly now.
Mm.
You can go there pretty much any time now, and something will come back that you'll get, whether it be somebody running upstairs, you'll hear them running along, or you'll see a shadow, or you'll see something small. Again, it's child-based.
Mm.
It all feels like a child. But it happens more frequently now. To the point now where we can just take in somebody around the lake. Recently, we had a couple from Australia. They came over and they wanted me to take them out somewhere. So I took them to the lake house. And instantly, they were sort of picking up on a young child. And they had a spirit box going, and they had all these other sort of gadgets that I wouldn't use myself. But they were picking up on the fact that their answers and what they were picking up on were kind of childlike. They got that sort of childlike vibe that was coming. And that was on their first visit. So I don't know.
Would you say it's the most prolific haunting you've investigated, Mark? The one that seems to be the most regular and responsive?
Well, I mean, I've travelled a lot. I've travelled all over the UK, around Australia, all around New Zealand. But I haven't really experienced what other people have experienced too much.
Mm.
I was quite disappointed with the UK. I love the UK, and I've stayed in some of the most haunted places around the UK, and I've experienced nothing.
Yes, as you were telling me when we were chatting.
The ancient ram inn, I've spent there twice now. Sleep there by myself on the floor. I never sleep on their beds because I don't want to disrespect the beds.
Yeah.
So I always sleep on the floor uncomfortably.
Yeah.
But I've experienced nothing at all. 30 East Drive in Pontefract, I've done there twice now. Nothing. And yet on either day of me being there, the day before, we had so much activity. The day after, so much activity. And yet the day I stay there, nothing happens at all. So I have to question whether it's me or whether none of it really actually happens. Or maybe, maybe people are just too gullible or naive and they're just believing everything, every sound. Maybe too many people are using apps and just believing too much of their apps.
Hmm.
Because I've noticed that people use phone apps with words. That becomes their evidence.
Yeah.
And if they get a lot of words that kind of make sense in their own mind, that's their evidence. So they'll come away from that thinking we had so much evidence at that location where all it was just words that kind of made sense to them.
Mm.
Whereas I don't sort of follow that way of thinking. So I guess it's a bit of a downfall on my part that I'm not getting as much evidence as them.
Yeah.
But I guess it depends on what you call evidence.
Yeah.
You know, for me, evidence is something that's there, that's without a doubt, it's right in front of you. It happened and it's right there. Whether it's not documented, doesn't matter to me personally. A lot of people say that anecdotes don't mean anything, that stories don't mean anything. But to me, it does. If I experience something that's right in front of my face, it happened.
Mm.
It's the same. I see a lot of Bigfooter stories where people say that Bigfoot stepped right out in front of them, was right in front of them. He could see it clear as day. It was right there. Yet the more skeptical or the more scientific in the community will say, no, it doesn't mean anything. It's just a story.
Mm.
But to that person, it means a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm the same.
Yeah.
I'm the same. Yeah. If it happens to me, then it means a lot to me. That's all that matters.
Yeah. I think sometimes, as you said earlier on, when you were talking about some of the conversations you had with abductees, Mark, I think when you speak to people on a regular basis, you can, not that we're able to sort of pull apart somebody who's living a fantasy or something, because there will always be people like that, regardless of any field of investigation. But sometimes you can hear a report or a witness talking about an experience, and there seems to be a genuine emotional change when they discuss it. As you say, I've seen people break down and cry when they're talking about encountering a Bigfoot. I've heard people talk quite fondly about encounters with spirits in their own home, as though they've built some kind of friendship with them, and they feel comfort with them being around. And so when you have situations where people go, well, I know that doesn't exist, therefore that person's wrong, or the usual one for Bigfoot, well, they probably just didn't realize it was a bear. I mean, I've spoken to people who've seen something within 20 feet of them, and with the greatest respect, I don't care how short-sighted you are, you're not going to mistake a bear. And usually, if a bear's that close to you, you're not going to be around to talk about it.
Yeah. I like to give people the benefit of a doubt. And, I don't like to judge people too much. If somebody says that they saw that, well, I wasn't there, so I'm not going to dismiss it. They're telling me they saw it. I think, okay, great. Okay. Mm. Let's hear more.
Mm.
I tend to just take things at face value at this point until I can sort of figure it out for myself.
Yeah. Have you had much experience with residential hauntings, Mark? I know you mentioned a couple in the book Haunted Auckland. Have you had that kind of situation where you've had a family come and say, we've got something here and we'd really like to know what the hell's going on, because we can't keep blaming each other for things moving about?
We used to. When we first started off, yeah, we did quite a few. But then we started to see the pattern. There were patterns. There were three types of people that we were encountering that were asking us to come to their house. One was mental health issues, which it was quite obvious. We used to have a questionnaire. We had a questionnaire that we would send out to people, and we'd ask them to fill in the questionnaire. And in that questionnaire, it had a few sort of personal questions about medication, mental health disorders, whether they had any of these. Most of the time, people would say, no, I don't have any mental health issues. No, I'm not on any medication. You get to their house, and you can tell straight off the bat that there's something not right with that person.
Mm.
You can see the little vials of medications up on their fridge, you know,
yeah,
for depression and all sorts of other things, you know. So if they weren't honest with me right at the beginning, we can't give an honest assessment of the whole situation, because they weren't honest right from the start about the condition.
Yeah.
And when it comes to mental health conditions, you know, while we feel for them, we're not qualified to be able to deal with such things.
Mm.
You know, if somebody is claiming that they've got a demon in their house, and you can tell straight up that this person isn't 100%, and is having, you know, issues with some sort of mental health issue.
Yeah.
The worst thing we can do is go into their house and fuel their fears.
Yeah.
And escalate everything. It's just the worst thing you can do. Mm. We aren't qualified to be helping. And what happens if things go worse? We went into one guy's house. He invited us to his house. He was a single guy. His wife had died a few years earlier. He claimed that every night at 9 o'clock, he was seeing images projected onto his walls. He was seeing things, people standing in his room. He thought people was breaking into his house. It got to the point where he was an alcoholic. He had a bottle of wine beside his bed, which he would drink a bottle before he would sleep. He had a giant machete. He had a machete knife on his bedside cabinet right beside him.
Blimey.
Because he thought people were coming into his house.
Yeah.
And so we went in there, we saw this whole scenario. We saw him, we saw the knife, we saw the wine, and we thought, yeah, we shouldn't be here. So, I mean, what can you do?
You know?
We've also had a lot of religious people come, fully devoted, you know, religious families that have come in where everything is demons.
Mm.
And they want you to come in and get rid of the demons. And when you try to come at things from a scientific or, you know, logical perspective, then that goes out the window to them. They don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
They've got demons, end of story. And so I try to explain to them that we're a research team. We're trying to research and find out about these things. We're not there to get rid of demons. We're not exorcists. We're not Ghostbusters. We're there to research and find out about things. But what they're really wanting is an exorcist because they believe that they've got demons in their house and they're living in fear. Yeah. Again, we're not qualified to be dealing with that as well. And then you just get the attention seekers that just want to be known as, you know, having gotten the Ghostbusters around to their house. And we've turned up to a few of them, actually, where we've been told of all this activity. We turn up to the house, and it'll be a Friday or a Saturday night, and we'll hear music playing. We'll get in there, and there'll be a whole bunch of ladies sitting around a table drinking wine and eating dinner. And they'll yell at, oh, the Ghostbusters are here. The Ghostbusters are here. And we're pretty much the entertainment for the night. And so we'll be trying to do our investigation with all this laughing and cackling going on downstairs at the table. And then they'll stagger up the stairs and they'll come along and they'll be holding their wine glass in their hand. And they'll be, so what are you guys doing? What's that gadget? What are you doing? What are you doing? You know, and all this sort of rubbish. So basically we're the entertainment.
Mm.
A lot of people like the idea of they've had the Ghostbusters come in to their house. It's kind of a favorite thing, I guess. So yeah, we don't really do private locations anymore. We don't really do. We have enough work anyway, just through historical locations now.
Yeah.
That we don't need to worry about sort of getting in the car and driving the team to somebody's house way out south or, you know, miles away just to sort of sit in somebody's house. Whereas, let's face it, we never really got anything back anyway. We never recorded anything because there were just too many contaminants.
Mm-hmm.
Many things that can go wrong, too many noises.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't do a controlled session in that kind of environment.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially when the owners are there.
Yeah. I'm always interested as well, especially because we don't get many opportunities for people to do it here in the UK, Mark, is prisons. And I know you've spent some time, is it Napier Prison?
Yep.
What's the general sort of situation with that? Because obviously over here there's a couple of notable places, but the majority of prisons that we've got in the UK have remained prisons for centuries, or they've been completely leveled and then moved to a new location. Whereas, you know, in the US as well, and I know in Australia, there are some places where they're just sort of boarded up and left. Is that the similar kind of situation in both the North and the South Islands, that you've got these kind of locations?
Not really. I mean, the prisons that we have here are either still functioning as prisons, so we can't get into those, or they'll be, but the Napier Prison, for example, is just a small prison. It's just it's not a very large, grand sort of prison like you'd have over in your country, Ian. Australia or the UK or wherever. We don't have those sorts of prisons, that sort of immense size. So the Napier Prison is just a small prison. It's very small, and it's but it does have a haunted history, and we've spent quite a bit of time there through the years. It's an interesting one. We get to sleep in the cells, and which is quite nice. And it's an experience, and I have experienced a few things there. I spent a night by myself, locked in by myself, and that was an interesting one there, because everybody heard that I was doing it, and even the people from Napier Prison asked me if I could do a Facebook live feed while I was there doing it alone.
Uh-huh.
So I tried. I spent a good hour and a half trying to get it going, but because of all the stone walls, the walls around the place, I couldn't get any reception.
Yeah.
So it was cutting off. It was all hopeless. I spent a good couple of hours just mucking around. It was just frustrating. And all around me, I was hearing footsteps. I could hear cell doors rattling. I could see shadows moving around. I was the only one there. But because I was so focused on trying to get this live feed going, I was missing out. So I ended up just saying, like, I'm going to stop this. I'm going to stop this. And so I cut the live feed because it kept freezing.
Yeah.
And it was just a waste of time. And then the live feed froze and then cut off. And then my wife rang me to see if I was all right. And she said that, I didn't hear it. I picked her up. I picked the phone up. And she said, all I could hear was her saying, hello, hello, hello. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Hello. And then it hung up. And I talked to her when I got back. When I got back, she described it as that when it answered, it just sounded like the sound of hell. It was just like screaming, like people screaming and noise and distortion.
Oh.
And it was just this, just the sound of just like the sounds of hell. You know, it's like people screaming and noise and distortion and just feedback and just. It was ridiculous. I mean, I didn't hear it on my end, but she heard it on her end, and it's just a pity we couldn't have recorded it.
Yeah.
But she was quite shocked that, oh, my God, what's happening? What's happening there? Yeah, I think she actually went on Facebook afterwards, and she posted, oh, my God, I'm not sure what's going on. I've just tried to ring him, and it sounds like, you know, all this noise, and hope he's all right. Have a nice night by yourself. It's interesting. But, yeah, we don't have the big grand sort of prisons like you do overseas.
Mm, yeah, because I've often thought if you're going to have certain characters locked away, Mark, and obviously hundreds of thousands of people have passed away in prisons all around the world, you would probably say that they're probably prime locations for hauntings, and it is quite frustrating. You know, I understand the legalities and the safety issues here. I'm not suggesting that we should give carte blanche to paranormal investigators to go wandering around high security prisons, but it seems to be the only kind of area in society where large numbers of people congregate that we don't really have that body of evidence. And I've heard a couple of anecdotal stories about staff who have had experiences in certain wings in certain jails here in the UK where there's a reputation for strange things going on. And I think it's a little frustrating because if you're going to have somewhere haunted, a prison would be a prime place, in my opinion, I think.
We've got one here. It's not too far from it. It's called the Mount Eden Prison. And it's still functioning as a prison. But there are certain parts of that prison which are no longer used. It's the older part of the prison.
Mm.
And those are the parts I'm trying to get into. But because it's part of the prison, security is tight and it's still functioning. They won't let anybody in.
Yeah.
So I've been trying for many years to get in there and I'm having no luck. But we do have lots of psychiatric hospitals that have sort of, you know, closed down and been utilized for other things. And so I've managed to get into quite a few psychiatric hospitals over here, which are, I guess, similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
So they've been interesting. I guess you get the same amount of energy as well, emotion and energy.
Yeah.
As a prison.
Yeah. Probably more so as well, sadly, because of the people that were using those facilities, Mark. I know, is it Kingsmead Psychiatric Hospital?
Kingsmead, yeah.
Yeah, that's got a bit of a reputation, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, we've spent many years investigating the various different villas. It's a huge complex. One of the buildings has been used for Spookers, which is a horror-themed park.
Oh, right.
And it's all decked out with lots of gruesome characters running around. And
yeah.
So that, which used to be the old nurses' quarters, that's now Spookers. And so people think of Kingsmead, they think of just Spookers.
Yeah.
But there's actually a whole complex of buildings. It's there's about 70 buildings on the land.
Wow.
And we've managed to get into about a good 20 of them so far. A lot of them are derelict and abandoned. They're too dangerous to get into, and so they're boarded up. We can't get in.
Mm.
But there are a few that are leased out to various families, like low-income families. You'll get about three families living in one villa.
Mm.
And these are massive villas. They're giant L-shaped, solid brick buildings that upstairs, downstairs, with multiple shower rooms and 20 bedrooms and massive kitchens. And, you know, they're huge buildings, and you can get them really cheap. So a lot of lower-income families are sort of getting in there and just sort of sharing a house during one of these villas.
Wow.
So there's a community going there, which is really nice. There's a lot of families living on the land.
Yeah.
And you get businesses that are using it for paintball businesses and various different businesses that are leasing the buildings, which is nice. So you've got this little community there based around an old psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've slowly been making our way through the villas there, but they're eventually going to be pulling a lot of it down. So it's not going to be there forever.
So what have you managed to capture any kind of strange phenomenon there? And is it one of those where, as you say, you've gone through several of the buildings that some of them are just duds, nothing at all's happening, and then you'll come across one that seems quite lively?
nothing amazing. Like we've slept in many of the buildings. We've stayed overnight and just slept on the floors. And we've captured various little bits and pieces, you know, footsteps and movement and shadows and taps and things. But it's such an old decaying building that you're going to get knocks and taps and bits dropping from the ceiling. And there are pigeons all around the place that break in, you know, a lot of open windows so the pigeons get in. So there's just so much noise that you can't really have a controlled environment there. But it's still, you know, it's a great environment. It's very suitably spooky and run down. And, you know, me being into horror, I kind of like those kind of environments. It suits me. I can quite happily sleep in one of those.
Yeah.
And, it's been good for what it is. I don't think we've had the return as far as paranormal evidence or activity sort of really from it. We've had more activity in the smaller places.
Hmm.
But it's just so nice to actually get access to those places.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a privilege.
Yeah. Especially as you say, if there's a renovation project going on, it's a finite amount of time you've got. So you've got to strike while the iron's hot, really, and you never know.
Yeah. Well, we're very big on a big part of what we do is documenting historical locations. And there's one that I've been documenting for about 20 years now. It's the Carrington Psychiatric Hospital.
Mm.
And it's slowly been torn down through the years. And I go there every few months and I take more photographs and I'm slowly documenting because one day these buildings aren't going to exist. They're not going to be around. So I like to sort of document them in their current state at that time. And so there's a bit of a timeline, which is nobody else seems to be doing, really.
Yeah. Well, I've always said one of the benefits, even if you're not getting paranormal experiences, Mark, especially if you love history and architecture and things like that, is the ability to get into some beautiful buildings that might be lost sooner than you think. And as we were speaking before we started the interview properly, you know, Sheffield is renowned for pulling down its most lovely buildings with saddening regularity here. And it's one of those things that I think we, especially here in the UK, we seem to have gone full circle where 100 years ago we were just pulling everything down, and now there's a lot of preservation and people trying to preserve things, which I know obviously every building can't be saved, or if it's not financially viable, but there's been so much beauty lost, I think, that it's good to see that people are trying to give some of these wonderful pieces of architecture and history a chance, because even if there are no ghosts, they're still beautiful buildings regardless.
Yeah, well, as far as I'm concerned, the whole haunted history goes alongside hand in hand with the building's history. It's a lot of people dismiss the haunted histories and the ghost stories and stuff like that, but to me they go way back, and if ghosts are a reality, well, then they are part of the past that are still hanging around today, whether it's a recording or whether it's something conscious and on the same level, we don't know. But they do go hand in hand with the history, as far as I'm concerned. I think they're very important, and I think we need to maintain these ghost stories, the stories of hauntings. We need to, if these people are replaying themselves from that era, we need to try and listen. We need to try and document. We need to try and, you know, immerse ourselves in it and really try and capture as much as we can from that, because it's either history repeating itself or still alive and still carrying on in some various other way that we don't understand yet. But it's still part of history in some way, and I think it's worth sort of documenting.
Mm, absolutely. Well, I think before I let you go, Mark, to enjoy the rest of your Saturday afternoon, sir, is there any location, because obviously you're a well-seasoned paranormal traveller, as you say, you've visited many of your favourite locations here in the UK and in Australia. Is there anywhere you've yet to visit that's on your paranormal hit list that you've always wanted to go? Because I know when we were speaking in September, you were off to see if you could find Jeff on the Isle of Man and other such locations, and you visited the gravesite of Harry Price. So you're a very well-versed man when it comes to the history of the paranormal here in the UK. So what's your number one you've yet to get to?
Japan.
Oh,
I would love to go to Japan. I want to go to that forest.
Oh, yes.
The Seafarer's Forest. That's just one place that's played on me for so long, even as a child when hearing about it. It's just a place that's drawn me to it, and I would love to go there and just, I don't know, I would love to camp a night there. I don't know how doable that is, but it's just something that I've always thought that I would like to do, just have a tent and just camp out deep in that forest somewhere. I think it's illegal. I don't think you're allowed to do that. But it's just something I've wanted to do, just spend time with just myself, some video cameras, recording gear, and just nothing else, and just sit and just listen. I mean, I've heard a lot of stories from that. I mean, how much of it's true, I don't know. I want to, again, I go where the stories are, and I want to go because the stories are so big and vast, and they're so dark as well. The stories are dark, and I've always been attracted to the dark side of life. So it's just one place that stood out to me that would be very morbid, quite uncomfortable to be in, I think. I think it would be an uncomfortable stay. But it's just one of the things, it's just on my bucket list. I just want to do it. It's just one of those things that I think if I've done that one, then I've probably achieved my pinnacle of what I could go for, what I could do, what I could handle. I like to push my boundaries. I like to push my limits and things and just face my fears and just do it. A lot of people that know me know that, I've been saying it since I was a child, but I mean, I've pretty much given my life to the paranormal. It is who I am. And a lot of people will be able to relate to that. It becomes who you are, and you have the journey that you're on, and you have that focus, and you're just going to stay on that, and nothing's going to turn you off. Nothing's going to detour you off into some other thing. You stay on that focus and stay on that goal, and I'm prepared to pretty much go where it leads me and accept whatever happens. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, aren't you afraid that something might attach itself to you and, you know, you may become possessed or it may affect you mentally in some way. And I said, well, it hasn't yet. And I think for me, you know, I want to find out about that. I want to find out what it's like. I want to experience it. Now, that means being picked up and thrown against the room and smashed against the wall. That's what I'm going to have to do. But I did say bring it on. Possession. Okay. If possession is a thing, okay, I want to try it. I can imagine it's the same as being hypnotized.
Yeah.
Possibly. Being under hypnosis. I can imagine it's something similar to that. I don't know. But we'll see. We'll see. I'm an open book. Let's bring it on. Let's see where it goes.
Well,
stupid, maybe.
I wouldn't know. I'm certainly in no position to judge anybody's levels of stupidity, mate. No. The things I've done in my life, mate.
Right. And I think if you want to find the answers that you want to find in life, and you just got to go out and look, because you can't just go through life believing everything that's in books or on the internet. Sometimes you just got to go out and just immerse yourself in it and just look for yourself. You've got to.
Absolutely.
Firsthand.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure to finally sit down with you and have a chat about your work and your history and some of the wonderful things that you've got up to down there in New Zealand. Where can everybody follow your work, find your YouTube channel and get hold of a copy of your marvellous books, sir?
Most of the books I think are online on Amazon, or you can deal direct if you don't mind the ridiculous postage costs. But our website is just hauntedauckland.com. We actually changed our name recently. We used to be called Haunted Auckland because many years ago when we started, we just sort of didn't imagine that would become popular and well-known and as travelled as we are now.
Yes.
We figured we would just be a bunch of people that would hang around Auckland,
yeah,
our own hometown, basically investigate a few places, and that would be the end of it. But we started to get invited to places all around New Zealand, then Australia, and then now I'm travelling to the UK. So we kind of expanded, and the word haunted didn't really sort of encapsulate everything that we do, because we're interested in so many other things like UFOs and cryptids and, you know, things like that. So the paranormal sort of covers more area. So we changed our name to Paranormal New Zealand. So Paranormal New Zealand is our new name, but we still have the old website, which is hauntedauckland.com. We can't really change that. Having said that, the website that we've had since 2009 has been called Paranormal New Zealand since then. So it's kind of gone full circle. We've actually changed our name into what we were called right at the beginning anyway. So it's a funny old world, how it works out. So hauntedauckland.com and just Paranormal New Zealand on Facebook. And that's where you find us, and Amazon for the books.
Brilliant. Well, I'll put links to everything in the show notes so everybody can track you down and follow your adventures, because I know you've got loads of videos and case notes and studies and investigations on the websites and on your YouTube channel and things. So I'll put links to that, and just want to say once again, thank you so much for your time. It's a real pleasure to sit down to you and speak professionally.
Thanks.
It was lovely to meet you last year, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Yes, we'll do it again soon, hopefully. Fingers crossed. Thanks, Paul.